micro-angles between the trailer and your hitch, or the fact that trailers are inherently assholes. If you attempt to recorrect your course, the laws of physics change. This actually happens. All of natural law reverses, and suddenly your pea pod is beside you, jackknifed in the boatyard parking lot. In this scenario, the boatyard is closed for the day, so the parking lot is empty. But there are two men standing at the edge of the parking area at the foot of the long dock that leads out to the harbor beyond. You don't know this yet. You've never spoken to either of them. But one of them is the owner of the boatyard. He is the son of the famous boat designer who started the boatyard. He is also the grandson of the famous writer. The other man is his coworker. They had been watching the ominous clouds over the harbor at the end of the day, but now they are watching you try to do something that not only you have never done before, but you have never really seen done before. Your best guess is that you're supposed to line up this trailer with the landing and push the trailer and the boat tied onto it deep into high tide, where your wife waits now to receive it. You have to get the whole trailer into the ocean without also getting your car into the ocean. And you have to do this while being watched by two men who make boats and launch boats of every kind and size, and have done so probably for 1,000 years because they are immortal maritime gods, and you are a dumb Icarus whose wax wings are melting under their gaze in their parking lot. Even without the context of this specific scenario, backing a trailer with a small boat on it into the water feels like this. The owner of the boatyard and his coworker watch placidly as I jackknife the trailer a second time and then a third. Their faces showed neither alarm nor derision nor care. They didn't offer to help me. They would never help me. My failure in front of their stone faces would be my punishment for being from away. I despaired. But then I remembered the lesson of the cairns and did something very unusual for me. I stopped steering, rolled down my window, and said out loud, "I do not know what I'm doing." Their faces immediately broke. I would not say they broke into smiles, but into a kind of neutral living warmth that they could deploy or reserve at will, like androids coming out of sleep mode. "We will help," they said. I had misunderstood them completely. They weren't punishing me by not helping. They were respecting my privacy by letting me fuck up on my own. But now that I asked for help, the maritime gods came to my aid. The co-worker did not take over for me, but he showed me how to adjust the wheel properly. The owner of the boatyard monitored my descent to the sea, calling out course corrections, guiding me to my wife, who was waiting like a siren in the tide. But just before the end of the maneuver, perhaps sensing the erotic metaphoric charge for which the sea is known, they left us alone. As I backed into the landing, I felt my back and neck press into the seat as gravity shifted, as the sky filled up my windshield. Behind me, unseen, my wife released the boat from the trailer as I mashed the clutch and brake flat to the floor in prayerful neutral. And then she said, "Okay," and I eased up on the clutch and released the emergency brake while gassing it gently into first to begin the climb back to land in low four-wheel drive. I don't know how to launch a boat, but I will brag forever about my skill with a manual transmission. I towed the wet skeleton of the unburdened trailer off to a remote corner of the parking lot and then kicked it for a while. My wife had rowed the peapod to the dock, and when I joined her, her eyes blazed with thrill. She told me that while she was tying up the peapod in the dinghy pen, the owner of the boatyard came by and showed her a new way to tie a bowline knot on the bight. I did not know what any of this meant. "Don't you know how to tie that knot?" I asked. "Not on the bight," she said. It's hard to overstate the disbelief and embarrassment, but redeeming excitement my wife felt about this encounter. Imagine meeting the most famous movie star you can think of, And now imagine having dinner with that person. And now imagine that that person is telling you about a time he went to a Scientology party. Imagine that person explaining he saw a Scientologist attempt to cure another partygoer's injured knee with a touch assist. And when you are confused about what that means, imagine that person demonstrating a Scientology touch assist on your wife. Imagine that person touching your wife's shoulder and saying, "Can you feel this?" And your wife saying, "Yes." And that person saying, "Thank you." And then that person is touching your wife's arm and saying, "Can you feel this?" And your wife is saying, "Yes." And the most famous movie star in the world says, "Thank you." Well, I don't have to imagine this scenario because it happened to me. My friend Sarah invited us to a play featuring one of Sarah's friends who happens to be one of the most famous movie stars in the world. And afterward, we all went out to dinner. And then, the star of many of my and your favorite movies, Scientology, touched my wife all over as I watched. And it was amazing. That is how surreal it was for my wife to get an impromptu knots course from the owner of the boatyard, the son of a famous boat designer, and the grandson of her favorite author. We couldn't go far in the Peapod. It wasn't designed for distance, but it didn't matter. Things were different on the water. Where Massachusetts had been my land, and Maine, at least the land part, had been hers, the ocean and the little shelter islands that we could reach as our rowing arms grew stronger were new and neutral territory. I would stand up in the boat, because you really could do that. You really could break that rule, because the Peapod would not tip or fail you, and I would scan the shore. Maine may be full of ambiguities and its sky full of shades of gray, but it can also be blunt, and sometimes its metaphors can be a little on the nose. So I regret that I must write, "That boat literally gave me a new point of view." A typical outing we would take would be to a little island, only a few oar strokes from shore. We would beach the Peapod for a moment so that our children could get out, and they would go off exploring on their own. You can walk the whole perimeter of the island in less than an hour, and that's just strolling. But even when your children are older, and they've demonstrated common sense and physical and emotional resiliency, all because of your really incredible, award-winning parenting, you still feel a pang of panic when they leave your sight. I would watch them disappear behind the trees as the shoreline curved off to the right, and there they would scamper on slick wet rocks, or fall and drown, or meet an ill-intentioned stranger, or whatever their fate might be. And then my wife would also leave me, taking the Peapod out on a solo row, following her deep, genetic Maine blood calling to the ocean and to misanthropy. I would watch her then disappear as the island curved around to my left, rowing her boat, utterly alone, the happiest I've ever seen her. They would leave me on the beach, an only child once more, and I would take off my shirt and go swimming. By the end of that summer, I had started swimming pretty frequently in the waters of Maine. I would not say that I learned to enjoy it. Even in August, when the water is at its warmest, it is still cold. But I did enjoy learning to endure it. There are transitions in life, whether we want them or not. You get older, you lose jobs and loves and people. The story of your life may change dramatically, tragically, or so quietly you don't even notice. None of this is ever any fun, but it can't be avoided. Sometimes you just have to walk into the cold, dark water of the unfamiliar and suffer for a while. You have to go slow, breathe, don't stop, get your head under, and then wait. And soon, you get used to it. Soon the pain is gone, and you've forgotten it because you are swimming, way out here where it's hard and where you were scared to go, swimming sleekly through the new. That is the gift of a Maine vacation. You survive it. And in that sense, Maine itself is a metaphor. And this is great news for me, because it means that I am technically not a Maine humorist after all. I am a metaphor humorist. And this is also great news for you, because if you get everything you need to from the metaphor, you don't actually have to go to Maine. And this is finally great news for me again, because I don't want to see you there. The spirit of Maine has infected me. I gave you your goddamn wood. Now get the fuck out of here. This is the end. Yippee. The first winter I spent in Maine, I was attacked by a barn door. There's a reason people write horror stories set in Maine, where bad things happen quickly, and sentient barn doors thirst for your blood. Maine is not full of vampires like I had thought, an original idea that only I have ever had. But it is still dangerous and haunted and empty. I've been as far north as Calais, but that is still on the coast. There is a world of dark inland forest beyond that, what one of our year-round neighbors has explored and named a great disappearing emptiness. And in the winter, even the coast feels underpopulated, a dark dream version of what you remember from the summer. The creepiness comes from that quiet, from the gray pall of the sky, from the fog called sea smoke, clinging to the surface of the reach on winter mornings, from the sad stories that sneak out from the shadows. It was last Christmas, the second year we owned the house. We decided to brave December there, and we had conned Jonathan and Christine and their family into visiting us. When they arrived, snow had fallen fast and thick, and our driveway was now an ice bowl. I was shoveling out a path across it from our house to the garage. I told you that our house was built to look like it was 200 years old by a carpenter with missing fingers on his right hand. He also built the garage. Upstairs in the garage was the tidy, modern mother-in-law apartment where the carpenter and his wife had lived when they were building the house, and where we now installed Jonathan and his family. Downstairs in the garage was once his workshop. The abandoned outlets and ventilation tubes still stick out of the concrete floor, where they once connected to the saws he used to mill the lumber to build the house with his own 1.5 hands. True to his fake antique vision, the garage was built to look like an old barn, with a great swinging barn door. It latched on the outside with a thick, wrought iron hook that curled to a sharp black point. I also told you that the carpenter and his wife built this house to grow old in, and I told you that they changed their minds. I didn't tell you why, but it wasn't a secret. When we walked through the house with him after the closing, the carpenter told the story, with the sort of calm of someone who has processed deep loss. He explained that their daughter's fiancé had died while visiting them in Maine a couple of years before. We were passing from the master bedroom to the upstairs bathroom. It was March, but we could still see snow on the ground through the window on the landing. My wife and I passed a moment of silent, wide-eyed marital telepathy. Did the fiancé die in this house? I mean, it was ghoulish to ask, and we don't believe in ghosts, but how could we live here without knowing? But sensing our worry, the carpenter reassured us that, in fact, it had all happened far away from here. He explained that his daughter's fiancé drowned on a camping trip. He didn't go into the details. Life did not just end for the fiancé that day. It was transformed for all of them, from happy vacation to unbearable sadness, in a few queasy, sad seconds. We got it. After that, he explained, their daughter didn't want to come to Maine anymore. She couldn't. So they were going to start over again, in a new old house, this one actually old, in another state in New England. After we completed the final walkthrough, we said goodbye in the kitchen. The carpenter and his wife handed us the keys. "We were hoping you would be the ones who bought our house," they said. "You were meant for it." They were very sweet, but it still sounded like a horror movie to me. Of course, the house was not haunted. But as soon as we bought it, the barn-slash-garage seemed to hunger for me. I had already had bad collisions with the electrical outlets in the old workshop. They grow out of the floor, metal boxes blooming on tubular stems at odd angles. My ankles would keep catching the corners of them. One bit a crescent gash into me that didn't bleed, but also never quite seemed to heal, leaving a scar that looks like a purple, crooked smile. I dodged the outlets again now as I put the snow shovel away and walked back outside. I was tired out and sweating beneath my winter jacket, but the path back to the house was straight and clean, and I felt good about it. I was just about to close the barn door, but the wind did it for me. It whistled and shrieked in the woods across the road, and I turned to listen to it, and then the door blew hard against me, impaling the wrought iron hook into my forearm just below the elbow. It went straight through my jacket. You know when an injury is serious the second it happens. Like, for example, when you are stabbed in the arm, while standing alone in cold air that carries the happy sounds of your family and friends across a frozen driveway to you, and you know you cannot get to them until you unattach yourself from this barn door. But even then, you also pretend that it's fine. You don't want to admit that it's serious. You don't want to admit that the next step is to pull the meat of your body off this iron hook, because who knows what will happen after that. Eventually, I did it. The hook made a slight sucking sound as I lifted my arm off it. I felt a warm, oozing wetness begin to blossom down my arm. I casually fast-walked along the path into the house, past my family in the warm fire and into the bathroom, where I could take off my jacket in private and see what I had done to myself. Surprisingly, my arm was not gushing blood. It was another of the barn-slash-garage's uncanny mystery wounds, a deep, fingerprint-sized hole burrowed into my flesh. I could see muscle and fat where the skin was pulled back, but out of it emerged just a slow ooze of reddish lymph. I poured hydrogen peroxide on it and applied pressure until it seemed to slow, and then I added several Band-Aids. "A funny thing happened," I said when I emerged. "The barn door attacked me with its iron hook, but it's not serious. Ha 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 ha. Happy New Year. I'm fine." I thought I was. Jonathan said, "I have my SUV. I could drive you to the doctor." I said that wouldn't be necessary. "But," I said, "don't we need gin and milk? Let's go to the supermarket." My brain must have really thought that I was fine and that driving through snowy roads in the increasing dark was really no big deal because we let my daughter come with us. It's normally a 20-minute drive to the supermarket, but Jonathan was driving half speed as new snow began to fall. Finally, my brain gave up on its plan to convince my body that everything was okay. I said quietly to Jonathan, "Do you know what? My sleeve is now full of pus, I think, so would you mind taking me to the hospital?" Jonathan said, "I thought so." He dropped me off at the ER of the local hospital. It's a good little hospital, small but modern, with a water view. In his later years, the famous writer would sometimes check himself in there for a little rest and attention. And he died there. I insisted that Jonathan not wait for me, but instead backtrack to the supermarket. "Get the milk," I commanded. "Get the gin." The ER waiting room was empty. I could not find anyone to see me. Finally, a man swam forward from behind a glass panel and took down my name and insurance information. He told me I was lucky. They weren't very busy that night. In fact, as far as I could tell, I was the patient of the hospital that night. He pointed to the hallway and suggested I walk down it. I did so. I went through one set of doors to another waiting room. Nobody. I wasn't sure what to do. It was scary. It was an abandoned hospital. Were there rusty wheelchairs tipped over at the end of the hall, or bedpans full of blood on empty stretchers? Did the fluorescent lights hum and flicker ominously? No, it's a very well-maintained little hospital. But it's an abandoned hospital, and wandering around an abandoned hospital in the middle of a snowstorm while pressing your palm onto your oozing armhole was enough to set the horror movie mood. I felt like I was the last person on Earth. "Finally," I thought to myself. But then they appeared, and they collected me, the nurses and physician's assistants who probably had given up on the night. They emerged from various swinging doors and smiled when they saw that I was not some child with cancer or a man who had opened his face on the kick of his chainsaw. This middle-aged dumb dad with a puncture wound would just be a welcome distraction on a winter night, not something that would keep them awake for the rest of their lives. A female nurse in scrubs beamed at me as she inspected my armhole. "Yep," she said, "that's a pretty good laceration." She seemed excited about it. It would be just a few stitches and then I'd go home. The nurse sat me down on a bench in an exam room. The paper on the bench was crinkly. She took my medical history. Having been a good and conscientious patient since my mom took me to see my first allergist, I knew the drill. Was I allergic to penicillin? No. Any drug sensitivities? I'd always been told not to take ibuprofen, but I don't know why, something to do with my asthma. It is an enduring mystery. Do I smoke? Not anymore. Do I drink? Yes. Do you drink every day? I had never heard this particular question in the medical rundown before. My inclination was to say no. I just drink socially. But socially means every day, every evening. My wife makes us martinis, and we talk about our days, as I cook dinner and our children ignore us. It's a great pleasure in our lives, this rediscovering of each other as our children age. It's our indulgence. But how do you explain that to a medical professional who clearly is screening for alcoholism? And then I realized I didn't have to explain anything because I'm a grown-up. And so I said, yes, every day. And then she looked up from her clipboard and said, yippee, me too. And that is true. And then we made out for a little while. That is not true. Just one more fake fact for old time's sake. What happened instead was a younger, shy guy who turned out to be an MD came back to poke a needle full of anesthetic around my armhole to prep for the stitches. Jonathan returned from the supermarket with milk and gin and my daughter. She got to come to my exam room to keep me company. I felt comforted by her. We took pictures of the wound to send to my wife, knowing that they would make her faint. Finally, Dr. Young Guy got out the curved little needle, a silvery modern miniature of the iron hook that got me. He used it to sew me up. He was nervous, and I wondered how many times he had done it before. My daughter watched the doctor closely with interest, and the nurse watched him too, probably knowing that she could do a better job. When it was done, Jonathan drove us back. Our rotten rock road had been plowed again by the time we made the turn off the main road. I saw our neighbor Clark, the retired pastor, on the Rotten Rock Road. He was walking his dog, and we waved to each other. I no longer consider my neighbors to be monsters, but friends. And Clark seemed glad that we had come to spend some of the winter and the dark with him and his wife. It was only a little farther until we reached our driveway, and then we were home. This is John Hodgman. I hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches, a book I wrote. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson. Hi, Kevin. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2017 by John Hodgman. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.